If there ever was a political strategist who could be considered a transformer of government, it would be David Axelrod. David has accomplished more in 40 years of political service than anyone in modern history. His new book, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics, shows an insight of reporting and campaigning to the highest level. Welcome to 3450, David.
Great to be here. Thanks, Joe.
Well, first off, as a journalist, you reported on big city politics, especially Chicago and
yes.
the Daley administration, along with the emergence of the black independent movement.
Yes.
Do you feel that time that the movement would shape into one of the strongest points in modern politician history?
I knew that it was leading to change, and I was the City Hall bureau chief, actually, at the Chicago Tribune when Harold Washington got elected mayor of Chicago, which was a stunning story at the time, almost unthinkable that there'd be an African-American mayor of Chicago and a reform-oriented African mayor of Chicago. But it was clear in the 70s that this was that there was this growing movement. And it is fair to say that that movement helped propel Barack Obama forward, you know, when he ran for the U.S. Senate in 2004. He really was standing on the foundation that had been laid by Washington two decades earlier, and it was gratifying to me to be a part of that. Harold had been long gone, but I knew he was smiling down on us that night.
You say in the book that when you were covering James Byrne, and of course we all know about the famous snowstorms
yes.
that happened in the area, when did Harold Washington take a look at you and say, I want you to be part of my group?
Well, you know, my first exposure to Washington was as a reporter. I was assigned by the Tribune to do a scene setter mm-hmm. for the 1983 mayoral race. In the summer of 82, I went to see him. He told me he absolutely wasn't going to run for mayor, loved being a congressman. He said, I'm going to set such high goals for the people who want me to run that they could never attain them in terms of voters registered, money raised, and they did. And he ran, he won, and he was in a brilliant, incredible figure to cover. And I switched over in 1984 to politics. I went to work for Paul Simon, who was another great character in Illinois and national politics, running for the U.S. Senate. And in 1986, when Harold was beginning to run for re-election, he called me over to City Hall, and he was in some degree of trouble, as much because of determined opposition from some of the white ethnic aldermen as anything else, and latent, you know, racism in the city. And he asked if I would help on his campaign, and he was one of the most unforgettable figures that I ever worked with. I really enjoyed him, and one of my great regrets is that he died shortly after he won re-election in 1987, and the only time Barack Obama ever met him was as a young community organizer at one meeting that Obama organized to protest something the city was doing, but he never got to know him. I have a feeling they would have been very, very close if they had had a chance to get to know each other.
So just an off-the-cuff question, did you and the President, President Obama, ever share a deep dish pizza to discuss politics?
I'm sure.
I know they loved it.
I'm sure we spent a lot of time together in Chicago, uh-huh. and I'm sure that we did along the way. Although I will tell you that, especially when he was running for president, we would be, and I wrote about this in the book, you know, they would bring in pizza and fried chicken for all of us, and they'd bring in fish and broccoli for him. I think they decided that his health, the fate of the nation rested on his health, and the rest of us were expendable. So we had fun, gained 30, 40 pounds. He ate healthy food.
So as one of the greatest political strategists in American history, do you still see a continuing evolution of the Democratic Party, the GOP, and even the voters?
Look, I think we are a dynamic country. Change is in our DNA. We are becoming a much more diverse country. You know, 26% of the people who voted in 2008 were black, Hispanic, or Asian. It was 28% in 2012. It'll be 30%. And by the middle of the century, you know, we're going to be a majority, what is now considered minority, country. So, there's going to be change. But the Democratic Party, it seems to me, is better positioned to accommodate that change. The real question is for the Republican Party, which is becoming more an older, white, sort of Southern evangelical-influenced party. And you can see that there are great strains in the Republican Party now between sort of governing conservatives and anti-government populists. And they're going to have to resolve these differences if they want to become a national party again, that is to say, win a national election. They'll continue to win congressional seats. They'll consider win local elections. But if they want to win a national election, they're going to have to become sensitive to the changes that are occurring every day in our country.
You created a coalition of Hispanics and blacks and young whites and just incredible amount. What were some of the factors that you used in order to create that?
Well, look, I hope that we created an aspirational coalition, a coalition of hope of people who felt that we could be a better and stronger country, that we could be a country of even greater opportunity, and that who were not resigned to the status quo or the status quo politics. And that particularly appealed to people who were left out. So I don't think it's any great mystery. And Barack Obama, given who he was, where he had come from, and what motivated him in public life, was the perfect leader for that movement at that time. I had the good fortune of people ask me, you were very flattering in your description of me. People say, well, how do you become a great political consultant? I always have the same answer: good taste. Have good taste. Find those candidates who you can believe in and who, reflect something positive and good and who have a story that you can tell that's compelling. And, he was a dream candidate in that regard.
Most people think that, political strategists and people like that with the president, it's always, happy, everybody's smiling all the time. But during the 2012, I believe it is, Mitt Romney discussion, you and the president didn't quite understand each other after his debate, and you kind of
critiqued it. I understood him, but it wasn't necessarily a pleasant discussion. Now, look, I write quite extensively in this book because there was a great deal of interest in it, and because it was an important story about what happened before that first debate in 2012 in Denver. We were worried about it from the start because incumbent presidents tend to do badly in the first debate. They haven't debated for 4 years. They're not used to having someone stand 4 feet away from them and being treated as a peer and accusing them of stuff. And so we worked really hard toward that debate, but it was very clear he wasn't. He was peevish. He was uncomfortable. He wanted to explain and defend more than he should have. And we had our last run-through before the first debate, the night before the first debate, and it just didn't go well. And my colleagues generously assigned me to go in and talk to him about it. And he said, well, I think that was pretty solid. What do you think? And I had a choice. I could either tell him the truth or tell him what he wanted to hear. Thought my job was to tell him the truth. It wasn't well received. And he used a word that he had never used before or since in reaction to what I had to say before he stormed out of the room. But I understood that it was, he himself understood that he wasn't really where he needed to be. And he was expressing his own frustration. And there's enormous pressure on these candidates before these kinds of events. But I must say, what's noteworthy isn't that exchange so much as how uncommon it was, because he was generally very gracious to the people around him. Not to say that we hadn't had arguments, but they were always very civil arguments. This was an unusual event, and it reflected the tension that he was feeling.
And you seem to have picked winners. I mean, Washington, Barack. I mean, you did some great everything. How do you look at the field today and look and see, is there any winners out there that can really help us? Putting you on the spot.
I always say that you're never as smart as you look when you win, and you're never as dumb as you look when you lose. And, I've lost plenty, but you don't really know People forget now that for much of 2007, the national political world, the pundits, the political community were really disdainful of Obama. They thought he had blown his opportunity. We had decided that the only way forward was to win Iowa. And we spent 83 days in Iowa in 2007. But at the same time, our polls elsewhere were falling. Our national poll numbers were falling relative to Hillary Clinton. And people were writing us off. And, in October of 2007, just a few months before we won the Iowa caucuses and 14 months before we won the presidency, there were supporters of Obama's donors who were meeting with him, urging him to fire his entire senior staff because they felt that we were naive and didn't understand, that he needed to get some good Washington hands in there. So you don't really know how a candidate's going to perform until you get really into the heat of battle when you're very close to these contests and in these contests. And that's how we learn about people. There are candidates with potential. First of all, I think Hillary Clinton was being written off earlier this year, and she came back smartly. And there are candidates on the Republican side who, who have yet to be tested, who may emerge here. But that's why the process is so interesting. It's fluid, and even though the media likes to treat every day like election day, it's a long process, and it has lots of unexpected twists and turns.
Was it hard to leave the president's staff?
Very hard. It was very hard. It was necessary. I was exhausted, and I knew it. He knew it. And I always knew that I would only serve 2 years. First of all, I have a child with disabilities, and my wife was back in Chicago, and I wanted to be back with my family, and I thought 2 years was all I could do. Secondly, I knew when we took office, we were entering at a time of an epic economic crisis. It was axiomatic that we were going to get our butts kicked in the midterm elections. And the way these things work is if you're the political guy, you're the first scalp that people in Washington want. And I knew that. So I was going to make it clear from the beginning. I was gone after 2 years. I was going to walk out on my own and not at anybody else's urging. And but once I did, it's like you're on this, you're going at warp speed, and everything you deal with is consequential. And the president, I'm in contact with him on a daily basis, multiple times. We're talking all the time. And all of a sudden, that all ends. I left on February 1st of 2011, and I flew back to Chicago. I had Secret Service protection because there had been a threat with me for much of my time in the White House. The agent who was most of the time with me, flew back to Chicago with me. We shook hands. He left. We were the last plane in before a big blizzard. It was completely silent in the city. And, it was like going from 100 miles an hour to zero. So I missed him. I missed the action. I really got very depressed for several months after that. It was only when I got back into the thick of the reelection campaign that my spirits picked up. So it was a hard adjustment.
Not to take anything away from yourself, but I love some of the comments about your wife, Susan.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
I was impressed by it, especially your first date.
Yes.
I thought that was kind of an interesting conversation.
Yeah,
that
was so interesting because, I was, I was a very active dater when I was a young man. I was when I was in college and when I was a reporter. And I kind of liked that. She was a beautiful young woman, as she is beautiful today, but so much so and so classy that it took me 4 years to, we were in a co-ed basketball game, it took me 4 years to have the nerve to ask her out, and I did, and we went out on this first date, and we had a great time, so much so that it scared me what a good time I had, and I just blurted out, and there may have been some margaritas involved in this. I just want you to know I'm not looking to get married. And she looked at me like she should have with absolute contempt. And she said, who the hell is asking? And then I realized, that's exactly the kind of woman I want to marry. And that was the greatest decision I've ever made in my life. She is a remarkable human being. And we've had a lot of challenges in our lives together, And she's been the rock that's held us together. Nothing else would have been possible without her.
And it shows in the book.
Yeah.
It was very good. Also, two questions. One is, you said co-ed basketball. Was she on the opposite team that beat you a lot? Or?
Yes. It was a pickup game. My somewhat coarse joke is one hard pick, and the next thing you know, I'm married, was what I always say. But she was a great – I mean, one of the things I admired about her was she's a great athlete, and she was so fluid and so graceful on a basketball court as she is off a basketball court. So that was one of the first things I noticed about her.
She's also accomplished a few things on her
she
own.
Has.
Can you tell us
a little
bit about that?
Well, you know, our daughter was born. Our daughter, Lauren, our first child, was a perfectly normal child until she was 7 months old. And then Susan found her blue and limp in the crib, thought she had died. And it turned out that she had had seizures in the night. And we went to the hospital and we saw her have a major convulsion. And they told us it would pass. And it didn't. They released us 10 a month later, she was still having 10 seizures a day. And this went on for some 19 years. And we tried all kinds of things to try and deal with this. And her life was a living hell. And it got to the point where Susan was so grief-stricken and so angry about what had happened to our child and to other people's children that she started an organization called Citizens United for Research in Epilepsy, started at our kitchen table. It's now the largest private funder of epilepsy research in the world. And you know, my wife was very shy when we met. She wouldn't even, notwithstanding that she basically told me to go jump in a lake when I misbehaved on our first date, but she wouldn't speak in a room full of more than 10 people. And now she travels the world, you know, evangelical about the cause of epilepsy research, not because it can help our child. Our child's grown now. The damage has been done to her. But because we want to make her experience count for other people and prevent this from happening to other children and families. And I think she is a heroic figure, really heroic.
Do you think that your mom was a journalist?
Yes.
Do you think were you around her when she was a journalist and kind of?
I wasn't, but she was just finishing up her journalistic career. Her paper, which was PM in New York, mm-hmm. folded in the late 1940s. And in the 50s, she was a freelance journalist when I was born. But before she went into qualitative research and advertising. But she always told my sister and me that she named us with a mind toward what it would look like in a byline. So much for self-determination. She had it in her head that I was going to be a journalist, and I was a journalist, and it was a great experience. It was the formative experience of my life to be a journalist.
Was there one thing that happened when you and Barack were together working that you'll cherish from now until, or was there too many to really do?
Well, there were things we shared. You know, the night we won the Iowa caucuses was the most, it was the purest joy that I ever felt in politics. And I had a number of moments like that with him. But, you know, maybe the most moving was the night that health reform passed. I had candidly, and I wrote about this, real reservations, even though because of my child's problems, we almost went bankrupt in the healthcare system. But I was so worried about the politics of it. And he basically said, look, what are we supposed to do? Put our approval rating on the shelf and admire it for the next 8 years? Are we supposed to draw down on it to do good things for people in the country? And when the night had passed, almost entirely because of his sheer will, I found myself walking into my own office at the White House, we were all together, and closing the door and crying, and in a really, I mean, I'm talking big sobs. And I couldn't at first understand why, and I realized it was because of what, because I knew that other families wouldn't have to go through what my family went through. And I went and found him and thanked him for that, and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, that's why we do the work. And that was a really crystallizing moment for me. It's what I've always believed. That's why my book's called Believer. But that one exchange really spoke to what politics at its best is all about it. It gives you an opportunity to do things that can make a difference for people and for communities and your country for generations to come. And that's a wonderful opportunity to have.
Two more questions before we end the interview.
Yeah.
One of them is, the world is in turmoil at the moment.
Yes.
For many different things. What do you think will be some of the factors that you can see that, not quite as extreme when you were in the White House working, but that seem to be very extreme for us now? What do you see our candidates
to
deal with?
Well, obviously, the events in Paris and terrorism are on people's minds now. I'm sure they will be an issue in the campaign. One thing you learn when you run in these presidential elections or when you work in the White House is there are always events that will intervene. We don't know what they all are, and it may be around terrorism, it may be around something else. So, you know, I'm not willing to sit here and say today that this is the issue that's going to determine the election. But one thing I do know, we've had a long-term challenge in this country over the last several decades that goes to the changing nature of our economy. We've had the median income today is what it was in 1999. 90% of Americans haven't effectively had a raise in 22 years. And there's a tremendous amount of anxiety in the country about this. I think this is the challenge of our time. How you deal with the changes in the economy, technology, that expands every day, that improves every day, that makes us more productive, but also, changes the nature of work and makes some jobs expendable. Globalization. These are things that we shouldn't and can't turn back, but we have to deal with the impacts of them. And I think that the economy and this element of the economy is going to be a decisive factor in this campaign.
Now the big question, where is David Axelrod going next? You've already changed history in a lot of different areas. What's next?
You know, I made a decision, Joe, after the 2012 election that I would never have a partnership or an experience to rival the one I had with Obama, and this was a good place to stop and get off the campaign merry-go-round. And that the best thing that I could do, I was always inspired every day when I came to the headquarters and saw young people working there. And I thought if I could work with young people and inspire them to consider careers in the public arena, that would be a great way to cap my career. So I started the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, extracurricular program. Where we bring in practitioners. We send kids out on internships. We have visiting fellows. And it's really been an incredible experience. Started in the January of 2013, we've already touched a lot of lives and brought a lot of folks to campus, and it's a very vital place. So that's one thing. I'm a commentator for CNN in this election. I'm really enjoying that. I'm doing some writing, short form writing, and I'm contemplating another book. You know, writing a book is challenging and it's draining, and so you have to reconstitute yourself to approach it again. But I'm kicking around a few ideas in my head for that, and also I have a documentary project in mind. So I'm excited about the future. There are a lot of interesting challenges ahead.
You know, after people read this book, they're going to want that second book.
Well, I appreciate that. Sometimes it's best to leave people wanting what they don't
have.
But I love writing. I really, my editor was right. She told me that Ann Godoff from Penguin Press, who's just magnificent, and she told me at the beginning, this is going to be very, very hard. And I was sort of dismissive. Hey, I've written before. And she said, no, this is going to be very hard. It was hard. But she also told me that when it was done, it would be one of the most satisfying things that I had done, and she was right about that as well. So I have to steel myself for the challenge of writing a book with the understanding that it's really satisfying once you've created something. And so I may get on the horse again.
David Axelrod has been with us here on 3450. His new book, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics, it's a must read if you want to learn a little bit of history, what's happened in the last 8 years. David, thanks for being with us today, and good luck on the second book. I'm pushing
the
second
book. All right. Thank you.